Every year, billions of dollars are spent on congressional earmarks, pet projects in home districts that are funded by federal money. And it seems that every campaign season, candidates rail against the explosion of earmarks in recent years. On today's second backstory segment, we will look at the role that earmarks play in politics today. And joining me now are Steve Ellis, Vice President of Taxpayers for Common Sense, and Dave Leventhal, editor of OpenSecret.org at the Center for Responsive Politics. I'm very pleased to welcome them to our show. Hi.
Hi, thanks for having us.
So how much federal money was actually spent on earmarks last year?
Well, in fiscal year 2010, there was $15.9 billion spent on earmarks.
$15.9 billion. That's a spit in the bucket, isn't it, when you talk about federal spending?
Well, it's certainly a drop in the bucket, yeah, as far as when you look at the total cost, although it depends on how you measure it. You know, you had a federal budget of $3.5 trillion, which is obviously quite a bit. You know, it makes the 15.9 a small percentage. But actually, you know, two-thirds of that is what they would call non-discretionary, things like Social Security, Medicare, that Congress doesn't really have their hands on or on autopilot. And then even when you look at the remaining $1 trillion or so that was in the discretionary side of the ledger, that's funds the entire Department of Defense, which is more than half of that. It funds every civil servant salary. So the discretionary part of the discretionary budget is a smaller percentage. And also, you know, I think to all your listeners, I mean, $15.9 billion is real money. And part of the way that we got into the huge deficit issue that we're in is that Congress, you know, these nickels and dimes, these billions and billions add up and they cause a bigger problem.
Is it have we been seeing increases over the years?
Well, we had an explosion in the dollar amount of earmarks between 1996, fiscal year 96, and 2005, where we hit the high water mark, which was in the about $23 billion, high $23 billion range. And then since then, there have been slight, you know, some decreases, as evidenced, you know, to get down to $15.9 billion. But it's been steady work, at least until now, and looks like we're going to go down to zero or near zero.
Steve, some have credited John Calhoun of South Carolina with introducing the first earmarks in 1817 for a highway project. Have they been used a lot ever since?
Not, you know, I mean, people go back to that, and actually I find it kind of interesting. There was a letter between Thomas Jefferson and James Madison, I believe it was James Madison, that actually talked about the first time of trying to get road projects funded through Congress. And they said that it would be Thomas Jefferson wrote that it would be a never-ending quest to see who could get the most money wasted in their district, and those who get the most will be the meanest. And so it's certainly been an issue over the years, but, you know, for instance, we looked at the 1970 defense spending bill, and we found a dozen earmarks. By 1980, we found 68. By 2005, we found more than 2,000.
Dave, when do earmarks typically get attached to a bill?
Well, they get attached during the entire process, and one thing that we have studied a great deal is who is exactly getting the earmarks and what they've done to potentially get them. And when you look at a lot of the defense contractors, we're talking Northrop Grumman, Boeing, BAE Systems, Lockheed, a lot of them are some of the largest lobbying entities at the federal level among all companies in the United States. So here they are getting oftentimes seven, eight figures worth of earmarks coming into their coffers for various projects, and yet they're also spending a great deal on lobbying, but not nearly as much as they're getting through the earmarking process and, of course, through other government contracts that they receive as well.
Well, aren't they supposed to go through a public process? Is one of the problems here that earmarks aren't very transparent?
That is a criticism, is that the lack of transparency that is involved with the earmarking process makes for this type of a situation where if you are a defense contractor or you are a different entity that is nonetheless receiving earmarks, that you're able to get that money, that taxpayer money, that government money, through a process that really isn't open and transparent, or at least initially so to the general public, who, of course, is paying for these earmarks.
Can the member of Congress who's attaching the earmark remain anonymous throughout the process?
Well, this is we've seen a shift, and Steve, I think, can speak to greater detail to that, but we've seen a shift in the way that the earmarking process has actually worked. And, of course, Daniel Inouye, the senator from Hawaii, who over the years has been one of the biggest proponents of the earmarking process, is ironically sort of on the knife's edge now of saying, well, we're going to hold back a little bit on exactly how we're going to go forward. So I think over the next couple of years, you're going to see the earmarking process continue to change quite a bit, where there may be more transparency at the very least, and at the most, the earmarking process stop or at least be put on hold altogether.
Well, so Steve, Senator Inouye, who has had many earmarks over the years, has announced recently that they'd be banned from this year's appropriations bills. But there was an article in The Hill earlier this week about whether the ban will be honored for the military spending bill. Why that exception?
Well, I don't think there is going to be that exception. I think that's going to be a real challenge for lawmakers, because Senator Inouye was really somewhat on the trailing edge of reform, and the fact that already the House Republicans had adopted a moratorium for the next 2 years on earmarks, which extended to the entire House since they're in the majority. Senate Republicans had adopted a moratorium on earmarks, and the president during his State of the Union said that if a bill comes to my desk that contains earmarks, I will veto it. And then he said it again, I will veto it. So I think that even in his statement, Senator Inouye recognized the writing on the wall that they were going to have to do this, and didn't want to have his fellow Democrats in the Senate to go through the exercise of submitting earmark requests, including when the bill, only to leave them on the cutting room floor. I think that there is going to be a challenge just because of the definitional nature of, you know, what exactly is an earmark. There's a lot of talk about, you know, that alluding to the late Supreme Court jurist Potter Stewart's observation on pornography, that earmarks are, you know, I can't quite define it, but I know it when I see it. And so I think that we all agree on 95% of what are earmarks, and there's this last few percent that are maybe big ticket items, like spending hundreds of millions of dollars on an alternate engine for the Joint Strike Fighter, that to us are earmarks, to Congress are not. And so that's where the debate will lie.
And Senator Lamar Alexander cautioned people not to overinterpret the moratorium as the death of earmarks. So will they just be given another name?
Well, I think that, you know, to some extent, yeah, we are squeezing a balloon, you know, and we are, some of it is going to squirt out in other areas, and there may be some sort of efforts to kind of end run the moratorium. But, you know, that's where groups like ours and constituents and your listeners can step in, because really we're trying to not just squeeze the balloon but let some air out of that balloon. And the way you do that is that we shift it from the political muscle process that Dave was describing to a project merit process, where we're actually going to allocate the money on the basis of merit or competition or formulas. You know, Congress steps in and develops the metrics and the criteria to evaluate the projects along with the administration, and then holds the administration accountable. And that's really what we're looking for. And so it's not that you can't have a decent project or important initiative funded by an earmark. It's that the earmark process itself was fundamentally broken, and we're trying to replace that with more meritorious funding systems.
Because we've been reading about any number of communities that voted for people who were against earmarks, and now suddenly that public library is going to be closed down, the highway isn't going to be widened, and they're kind of shocked that it applies to them as well.
Right.
So, but why haven't we just simply had more transparency in the past? Was it a matter of money, or was it it's one thing to build a bridge to nowhere. It's another thing to build a bridge that actually is needed to cross a river.
Right. No. And certainly, although, the Bridge to Nowhere was crossing a body of water, but...
cars might actually drive across.
Yes. It goes to a place that has more than 50 people, which is what the Bridge to Nowhere was going to. Gravina Island has only 50 people on it. But as Dave mentioned, there have been increases in transparency. You know, starting when the Democrats took control in 2007, you had a requirement that lawmakers' names be listed next to their projects. We then, in subsequent years, had a requirement that all of the requests submitted by lawmakers, not just what they actually got into the bills, but what they'd asked for, all be disclosed on lawmakers' websites. But, you know, what you realize is that online is not necessarily transparent, that essentially you had PDFs, you know, so documents that had these lists that we've actually converted into Excel charts and documents, and then worked with the Center for Responsive Politics to document the campaign contributions that go along with it. So, you know, we've had to do a lot of work to try to make this more transparent. Congress could have done more in that realm. And then also, you know, there were that $15.9 billion was 9,499 earmarks, and 9,499 lines of data is inherently opaque. You can scroll through it, but your eyes glaze over. I mean, and so at some point we were looking at, there were 3,000 earmarks in 1996, and we're, you know, even after we came down from the high water mark of 15,000, we're still talking about nearly 10,000 lines of data of how this is being spent, and with really little justification that we understand sort of the backstory about why this project and why not that project. And I think that's where these communities, there were a lot of communities, particularly in the areas of where you had flood and storm damage reduction projects or transportation projects, where earmarks actually hurt them, because the money was in the federal budget requested by the president, and Congress nickeled and dimed those programs to fund their other pet initiatives. So there were a lot of places where there were earmark losers and essentially lost out in the system and got less money than they would have had they not existed.
Well, Dave, was the stimulus bill, which funded proposed public projects, a way of funneling money to communities in much the same way that defenders of earmarks say they do?
The argument has been made that the stimulus package created a lot of projects that were very akin to earmarks. Now, the stimulus, we found a greater deal of transparency involved with that than perhaps we saw a couple of years ago with the earmarking process. But at the end of the day, what's going to be most curious is the political fallout of the decisions that are being made about earmarking, because you are, as you alluded to before, going to have a lot of communities that are sort of perhaps going to have buyer's remorse. Maybe they didn't want earmarks to exist in the form and fashion that they have, and that now they go away, and, well, what happens then? So it'll be a very curious exercise if earmarks, in fact, are on a moratorium this year to see what happens when that moratorium is over. And they just, a la the Bush tax cuts, have to make a hard decision as to whether to go forward with this going into the future or if they're going to continue to do something different and go back to the earmark system.
We don't have much time. But it has been suggested that much of this anti-earmarks talk has been grandstanding or political rhetoric, in many cases by people who then wanted their own earmarks. I look forward to talking to you both again about this as the situation progresses. And my great thanks to you, Dave Leventhal, editor of OpenSecret.org at the Center for Responsive Politics, and Steve Ellis, vice president of Taxpayers for Common Sense. We've been talking about earmarks on the second of today's backstory segments. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We support total transparency here.